Him after this.
This is Who We Are. Lioness, My Journey to Glory by Beth Mead.
Scoring that many goals in front of that many fans screaming my name was the biggest rush of blood I'll ever get in my career.
Welcome to the Neighbourhood with Jade Adams.
Is a seagull strong enough to break windows? Someone called Pori's now replied, does it have a hammer?
And the Music and Meditation podcast.
We're going to explore topics like how to deal with imposter syndrome to help us feel calm and step into life with a new energy.
Celebrating who we are. Listen on BBC Sounds.
We have another celebration here because this programme has reached its 50th edition. We're spending another half hour in the company of one of the world's favourite raconteurs.
Ladies and gentlemen, meet David Sedaris.
Such enthusiastic applause. Thank you so much for coming. There's a television show in America called CBS Sunday Morning, and they have like a little minute and a half slot. I'm on, I don't know, a couple times a year. I had one on not long ago about the word queer. I just can't stand the word queer, right? So I identify as straight now, just because... Just because the word never changes. I mean, my beef with the word queer is it's the fourth time in my life that I've been rebranded. So I just need a resting place. So this was one that I had on. Eat the Rich. I was in the breakfast room of a nice hotel in San Francisco, and as a maitre d' showed me to my table, I told him that I followed a strict Hegan diet. Vegan, he asked. No, I said, Hegan. I only eat things that were male. I'm hoping that's all clearly marked on your menu. His face fell. I'll need to know what sex my eggs are, for instance, if I decide to get eggs, I said. Sausage, being such a hodgepodge, is impossible for me, but I do enjoy bacon from time to time. It just has to come from a boar rather than a sow. I'm assuming you can verify that for me? At a diner, you'd be laughed out of the room, and for good reason. But in a fancy restaurant, it's, let me talk to the chef. I tried the same line at dinner that night, and again, I let it sit for a moment before admitting that it was a joke, something I just made up. Well, thank goodness, my waiter said. I mean, this is California. We get it all here, so I naturally assume this was a new thing. What, I wonder, would be the point of Heganism, other than making yourself seem unique or righteous in some way? Though that often seems reason enough. There are hardcore fruitarians who only eat things that fell to the ground naturally, thus sparing the apple or orange or fig tree any unnecessary trauma. Then there are freegans who don't believe in waste and only eat food that they find and don't have to pay for, including roadkill. I met a guy in a plane once whose daughter had just gotten sick from eating an overripe raccoon carcass. She's definitely her own person, he told me. In the movie Trans America, one of the characters identified as a level 4 vegan, explaining that he only ate things that didn't cast a shadow. Is that real, I wonder? It wasn't, but I was fooled until I looked it up. When it comes to food, or face it, food in wealthy, industrialized countries, nothing's too crazy now. That's why when I saw the words, eat the rich, spray-painted on a building not far from my hotel in San Francisco, I thought, as had my waiter at dinner the previous evening, really? Is that a thing now? This next thing I'm going to read, it's a graduation speech I gave to Oberlin University in America. It's a school that's often talked about in the news, like they picketed the cafeteria because they were serving sushi. And it was cultural appropriation. Like, the students get upset about everything at Oberlin. And I gave this commencement address, and afterwards, someone charged the stage trying to attack me, and he was confined. And it was the father of the one conservative student who's ever gone to Oberlin. And he was upset by a joke that I tell here. And they don't pay you much at all to do a commencement address, you know? And it's really not like you can use it for much else. So, a speech to the graduates. Thank you so much for having me and for presenting me with this honorary degree. It's not necessarily better than the one I earned by going to classes and putting myself into debt, but I'm trying to collect a stack of them before I die, so I really appreciate it. And congratulations, graduates. This is quite an accomplishment. Like most of you, I am incredibly grateful for the education I received. A good public school followed by college. I went to 3 in all, looking for the right fit. The first 2 were okay, I guess, but midway through my sophomore year, I got heavily into drugs and dropped out. Everyone said that was it. I'd made an irreparable mistake at age 20 and could never correct it. But I did. The place that I eventually graduated from, the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, has its qualities, but is nowhere near Oberlin when it comes to academics. It might be different now, but in 1984, if you could draw Snoopy on a cocktail napkin, you were in. I received my Bachelor of Arts degree in 1987, when I was 30. Our commencement speaker was a conceptual artist named Vito Acconci. He'd done a lot, but was best known for constructing a wooden ramp in a New York gallery. Then he hid beneath it and masturbated for several weeks without stopping. Well, you could do that, my mother said. When I explained to her who he was. I mean, isn't that the goal? Doing what you love and getting paid for it? I don't think she understood a word of the man's commencement address. I'm not sure I did either. In preparing for today, I asked myself what he might have said that would have had any effect on my future. I figured my post-college life would be pretty much like the one I'd been leading for the past decade. Work some little job I didn't have to put much thought into, then come home and do my own stuff. It was the life that most of my friends led, and half my family. My sister Gretchen went to the Rhode Island School of Design for painting. Then there was Amy at Second City, and boy, did our father give us grief about it. Art or comedy is all well and good, but you need to find something to fall back on, he'd say. I hear this from parents all the time when I meet them at book signings. Our daughter is an aspiring writer, and we told her that's fine, but she needs to find something to fall back on. So, she's a terrible writer, I ask? Well, no. Is she lazy? Has she shown no improvement since she started? Of course not, the parents say. She's wonderful. Writing is all she cares about. Then why does she need to fall back, I ask. Are you saying you have no faith in her before she's even had a chance to prove herself? That's an unfair question on my part, as it makes the parents sound unsupportive. What they mean is that they don't want their child to be broke and to suffer rejection. But there are plenty of worse things. At 22, you are built for poverty and rejection. And you know why? Because you're good looking. You might not realize it this morning, but 30 years from now, you will pull out pictures of yourself taken on this day and think, why did nobody tell me I was so goddamn attractive? You maybe can't see it now because you're comparing yourself to the person next to you or 2 rows up. But you are stunning. And let me tell you something else. When you were on your deathbed, or at least, say, 64, the time you'll look back on most fondly will not be the day you bought your first Picasso painting at Sotheby's, the little still life done in 1921. Oh, am I alone in this? But the years after you graduated, when you were first living as an adult and everything seemed so possible, maybe nothing worked out the way you planned, but still you thought it would, were convinced that it would. You were most likely broke and living in some crummy apartment, but it was your apartment, and you were good looking. I guess I'm saying that these next few years could be the best of your lives. Just don't blow it. But how, you're thinking. I was going to tell you not to rush into anything. Don't become an adult quite yet. Take a wild chance, and whatever you do, don't move back to your hometown. Especially don't move back in with your parents. But who am I to say that to a 22-year-old owing $120,000? I'm not sure your generation has the luxury of drifting across the globe, trying this for a while and then that. How do you find yourself when, before you've even started, you find yourself in debt? So there goes that advice. Here, though, are a few things I can tell you. One, when it comes to scented candles, you really need to watch it. There are basically only two brands worth having, Trudon and Diptyque. I can't afford that, you're probably thinking. Not with this $120,000 debt from my degree in dance history. To this I say, fine. You'll just have to go without scented candles until you can afford Diptyque or Trudon, or until someone gives them to you. Two, choose one thing to be terribly, terribly offended by. This as opposed to the dozens or possibly hundreds that many of you are currently juggling. Three, stand up for what you believe in, as long as I believe in the same thing. Those of you who'd like to ban assault rifles, I am behind you 100%. Take to the front lines, give it your all, and don't back down until you win. Do not, however, petition to have a Balthus painting removed from the Metropolitan Museum of Art because you can see the subject's underpants. The goal is to have less in common with the Taliban, not more. Four, be yourself, unless yourself is an asshole. How will I know if I'm an asshole? You're probably wondering. Well, pay attention. Do people avoid you? Every time you park the car or do your laundry, do you wind up engaged in some sort of conflict? An example, not to pat myself on the back, but I've been doing some work these past few years with a group called Love, Hope, Strength. What they do is get people to donate bone marrow. And what I like is that they allow me to tell outrageous lies about them. If you sign up, I promise audiences at my readings, you will get to have sex with the most attractive member of the cancer patient's family. Young or old, they cannot by law refuse you. People don't donate their bone marrow in the theater, of course. Rather, someone swabs the inside of their cheek and they fill out a quick form. It's rare to find a match, but it does happen. The cutoff age is 50, so I tell the audience that. Then I announce that whoever registers with Love, Hope, Strength can come right to the front of the book signing line. This is how you get your donors. That said, if I have, say, 2,000 people in the theater, 50 might take the bait. That doesn't sound like much, but it's actually a good number, And if you're going to 40 cities, it adds up. So I'm in Napa, California, and this woman, maybe around 65, claims that I'm being ageist, and that if I don't let her cut to the front of the book signing line, she's going to take the producer of the show to court and sue for discrimination. Now, this is a fairly small theater. I have 20 people who've signed up to donate bone marrow. I told the audience that it doesn't hurt at all, that they can, in fact, undergo the extraction while they're having sex with the cancer patient's family member of their choice. This is the biggest lie of all, as it is, in truth, an excruciating procedure. Here are 20 people willing to endure a great deal of discomfort, not to benefit someone they know, but to possibly save the life of a complete stranger. That, to me, is real heroism. And this woman says that unless I let her come to the front of the line, she'll sue. She's taking her selfish desire to get home as quickly as possible and masking it as a fight against injustice. Now, that's an asshole. The person you never want to be. I wrote in her book, "You are a horrible human being." And of course, she laughed, thinking I was kidding. That's the drawback to writing humor. People always think you're kidding. "No, I mean it," I told her. "You're awful." She laughed harder. 5. Always have a few jokes up your sleeve. They come in handy at casual get-togethers and probably don't hurt at job interviews either, depending on what position you're applying for. Here's one my friend Ronnie told me that's timely, quick, and easy to remember. It's night, and a cop stops a car a couple of priests are riding in. "I'm looking for two child molesters," he tells them. The priests think for a moment. "We'll do it," they say. Six. This last bit of advice is something very few of you are going to take, which is unfortunate. It's just as important as what I told you about scented candles. And it's this: write thank you letters. On a practical level, it's just common sense. People like doing things for people who are grateful. Say your grandmother gives you $100 as a graduation gift. If she has 8 grandkids who are or will be in the position you're in now, I guarantee that yours will be the only thank you note, not a text or email or Facebook message, but an actual letter with a stamp on it that she receives, and she will treasure it. Then, a few months down the line, you can write again, telling her that you just spent the last of the money she sent. "I was at a charity shop buying a dress I can wear for my job interview tomorrow," you could say. "The skid marks will hopefully come out after after the first wash. And as for the underarm stains, I guess we'll see. But as I was paying for it, I thought of how kind you've always been to me and of how very lucky I am to have you in my life." Chances are around 80% that she'll send you more money. Not because you asked for it, but because you're grateful. I've talked to employers who say that applicants who send a thank you letter after an interview go right to the top of the pile. When I go on a book tour, I write to everyone who interviews me, to every store and media escort. You know who else does that? Nobody. It's not because they're not grateful. They are, most likely. Rather, they just think, oh, people will understand. And they will, of course. Your grandmother's gotten used to sending you gifts and never hearing anything back. Well, she thinks, as you lie around texting someone in the next room about something you've just seen on TV, he's busy. But here's the thing. She's busy, too. Yet she takes the time to send you stuff. I'm not trying to be a guilt monger. I'm trying to help you. And who am I? a fairly successful person. One with a Picasso painting and a number of books under his belt, who will go home at the end of this day and write to the president of Oberlin to thank her for this degree that I do not deserve, but am so incredibly grateful for. Wanted to have something in a trade publication. You know, like people who make bricks have their own publication, and people who train animals have their own publication. And so I wrote this for Poets and Writers, which is a trade publication for me. I was in Central Park one afternoon tying my shoe when two sparrows landed on the back of a nearby bench. A child seated not far away noticed them as well and said to the woman I assumed was her nanny, "Look, they're friends." It's what a kid would say. Honestly, though, how close could the two birds be when their survival meant competing for the same meager crumbs? It's like that with writers as well. And it's the reason I hang out with so few of them. When my old friend Ted tells a funny or interesting story and I laugh at it, he's pleased. When a writer tells an interesting story, he'll most often follow it with, "I'm already using that." It's why I spend time with lay people, mainly graphic designers for some reason. When I do meet other authors, I tend to steer them towards shop talk. Their company made me realize that the things I thought happened only to me happened to everyone. Especially at a book signing table. How many times have I gone on a lecture tour and had someone say, "I tried to get my coworkers to come with me, but none of them had ever heard of you." Why would you tell me that? It's not like I assume that everyone knows who I am. It's not like I go around implying it. "I got your book in the remainder bin for $1.99. Is another bit of information people should probably keep to themselves. Since Barrel Fever came out, I have been asked at least 400 times to sign something that I didn't write. Naked Lunch, White Fragility, The Dummy's Guide to Cryptocurrency Investing. Everyone thinks this is the funniest thing in the world. Sadder still, they think it's an original idea. In fact, it has happened to every writer I have ever spoken to. When I explain, as I always do, that it feels disrespectful to sign a book I didn't write, even if the author is long dead, the person always pushes back, "But this is all I have." "Well, then you came unprepared," I'll say. Another thing authors get is, "You signed this book 3 years ago. Now I want you to do it again." "But it's already signed." "Yes, so do it again." I don't know what this is all about. Here, too, the person on the other side of the table thinks they're being original and outrageous. I, meanwhile, am looking at the long line and thinking, don't I have enough on my plate without signing something for the second time? In 2021, a woman put a book in front of me saying, "You inscribed this for my son, who has since died. Now I want you to sign it to him again." I looked at her and then at what I had written. "I don't understand. My son died. Before that happened, you signed this book to him. Okay. Now sign it to him again." "But why?" I asked. "Look," she said, impatient now. "My son is dead. He died, okay? And I want you to re-sign his book." I felt bad for her, but at the same time I thought, why are you laying this on me? It's like when people say, "Can you inscribe this for my friend Lawrence? He's in the late stages of pancreatic cancer." What can you write in such situations but, "To Lawrence, I hope you're a fast reader." It's interesting to go to other writers' signings and see how they handle themselves. Everyone, it seems, is at least 10 times faster than me. I thought he'd never shut up. I imagine people thinking as they race away from my table. My record is 10.5 hours. That was at a Borders in Chicago. There were a number of 9-hour sessions on that same tour. How awful for you, people would say. But I enjoyed every moment of it, or almost. Contrary to many of the authors I've met over the years, I actually love signing books. It's a whole reason I write them. And it bothers me when people ruin the experience by being bossy. I want you to inscribe, "Keep laughing." But that's nothing I would ever say. I'll try to explain. Plus, it makes me sound conceited, like I'm so certain that my book is funny. Well, that's what I want. But I already wrote "Go Back to Whore Island." Then change it. Similarly, someone will say, "You drew a picture for the person in front of me. Why didn't you draw one for me?" Because I gave you a rubber stamp of a man defecating on the ground, and the two things don't really go together. Well, I want a picture too. Oh, and the number of books that are sent back because someone misinterpreted what I had written. You inscribed my copy of Theft by Finding with "Friendship is a cancer," a woman complained in a letter once. How could you possibly be so insensitive? My dog died of cancer. "Friendship is a cancer" isn't about cancer. It's about friendship, I wanted to say. It's not a sentiment I personally believe, far from it. But for reasons I can't explain, it seemed like a pretty good thing to write in a book. The same is true of "Your town is crazy and has AIDS." I mean, it beats "best wishes." Or "what you get more often than that," which is nothing. No personalization, not even a glance up. Only once have I taken a request. It was from a dynamic 15-year-old in Jackson, Mississippi, named Troy, who wanted me to write, "You were like a son to me." "You got it," I said. He made me so happy, this kid. I liked him even more when he told me that for Christmas he wanted a donkey and a vintage Adidas tracksuit. Troy must be in his mid-20s now. The essay collection I signed for him has long been thrown away or taken to a Goodwill. That's where I imagine all my books winding up, and it's why I won't inscribe them with things like "keep laughing." If I were a charity store shopper, I'd look at that and think, "Yuck, I don't want to read this fathead's writing." "Go back to Whore Island," though. Now that's how you snag a new reader. Thanks so much for coming out today. We really appreciate it.
"Meet David Sedaris" was written and read by David Sedaris. The producer was Steve Doherty, and it was a Giddy Goat production for the BBC.
And we're invited to meet David again next week, when he'll be revealing how he coped with lockdown in New York City and recounting an altercation with a cash machine in West Sussex. Looking forward to that. Meanwhile, tonight, Alice and Adam wonder what's for the best and why is Susan in need of a top hat. We'll be donning our green wellies and heading to Ambridge after the news.
Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley.
This is the story of how an ordinary woman who witnessed the violent killing of her husband found herself on trial for his murder.
A new run of the acclaimed series, which looks at the crimes of women in the past from a contemporary feminist perspective.
Can I get away with this? How far can I go?
They're basically saying she gets off because she's posh.
True crime meets history with a twist.
What have I done? I have been married 6 months and it has been...